And you're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's almost 7 o'clock, and we will be joining Patty Kostelic with the Home Fires radio show.
Good evening. I'm Patty Kostelic, and this is the Home Fires radio show. With me this evening are some gentlemen. We're going to talk about building. And I'm going to start with a little piece that was written by a friend of mine, Merritt Helfrich, as a foreword to Joan Kopanen's book, Building from Within. At the end of each winter in Fairbanks, Alaska, the first advent of spring is not blooming pussy willows, longer hours of daylight, or the soul-stirring honking of geese returning from the far south. No, the first traces are to be found, oddly enough, inside bars, restaurants, and other gathering places. There, on coffee-stained placemats and on soggy bar napkins, are penciled doodles, which, on closer examination, turned out to be scribbled house sketches and obscure construction details. The manic fervor of this drawing occurs for two reasons. The building season is short between cold, dark winters, and a dwelling in Alaska is often much more than a simple acquisition of shelter. It is rather a personal statement, an emotional experience, and an ego-reinforcing trial. To take hammer in hand and translate one's ideas into a structure is a strain, physically and emotionally. The process is hard on marriages. It also teaches the builder that whatever else he was at the beginning of the project, he was probably not a carpenter. The winter dreams rise unsteadily from those scraps of paper into the reality of a unique house. There are times when all seems lost, and the best solution appears to be to burn the darn thing down and call a contractor. Weeks turn into months, or years, but later, those low points seem just milestones on the way to the final triumphant placement of the last shingle or switch. What gets into people that causes them to build their own? Here, labor costs are high and housing short, but this is not a sufficient answer. The wit and whimsy expressed in the homes and driving motivation seem to go much beyond mere practical considerations. So that's Merritt's introduction. With me in the studio this evening are Axel Carlson, someone who has many years of experience with the Extension Service, and his specialty is building in Alaska. Darwin Syme, who's I guess vocation, his avocation became his vocation, and has been building professionally for the last 12 years. Is that
That's close. Sense?
And Carl Castle, who is with the University Programs Department, and he has built a few homes recently in the last couple of years, and he's about to leave his present profession and go into building full-time this summer. And he won't call himself an expert, but he has some experience, and he's going to be here to at least help me ask the questions. Our number is 474-5044. I know this is a subject on which many of you are expert, and I certainly hope that you will feel free to join us in the discussion of building. Axel, would you like to start and just tell us a little bit more specifically about your background and your experience in Alaska with building?
Well, as far as Alaska is concerned, I've been here, 20 years, I guess, and I retired 3 years ago. And been working harder since I retired than when I was working. So
that's what they say is always the way.
But my primary experience has been in construction, been in that business for the last 40 years. And I was a carpenter, a journeyman carpenter, ship builder apprentice, military engineer, and was at Penn State. And I spent 10 years in maintenance and construction of buildings for the state of Michigan, so it's been a long period in construction. It's always something new coming up, and it never gets boring.
Did you find the transition from the techniques of Pennsylvania and Michigan to Alaskan techniques a difficult one? Or?
No, I really didn't. I think a lot of people in the lower 48 seem to think Alaska is unique, but I think it's only unique from the standpoint that we do have long winters. So if you have, for instance, a condensation problem, it'll show up perhaps the first year. But lower 48, they have condensation problems, but it takes 10 or 15 years before you see the ugly results of rotten framing and things like that.
But so, sound building is sound building, so. Darwin, would you like to tell us a little bit about, we talked a little bit before the show, about what brought you to Alaska and what you were doing then.
Yeah, I've been in Fairbanks 20 years, too. Not initially coming here as a builder, but coming here to the university, the graduate school. Transferring here into the wildlife department, so I worked with wildlife biology for a while, and then taught school here, biology primarily in the local school system for a number of years. Taught a little bit in southeastern Alaska, and then, but somehow always came back to Fairbanks. And as I was teaching, and even when I was going to school, I worked my way through school as a carpenter, working for an uncle who built custom homes, and always interested in that. And as I mentioned earlier to you, I got into this sort of as a more as an avocation rather than a vocation, and it just kind of took off from there. And so I've just been making my living just building now for quite a number of years, and it's just basically in the Fairbanks area.
And Carl?
Well, I'm certainly not the expert builder like the folks we have here with us today. I decided after I got here to try my hand at carpentry. My father was a carpenter, and he had given me the basics involved in carpentry. So I decided to build my own cabin, that Alaskan dream that so many folks have. And I built a cabin for myself in another small place. And I've been involved in helping some other people since then, building some other places also. So I'm just sort of a do-it-yourselfer who has given it a try. And I think all of the places that I built are still standing and maintenance-free, so I must have done something right somewhere.
What would you think that your motivation in the specifically the first cabin you built? All your friends had done it. You wanted to do one, too? Or I mean, do you remember what your thought process was?
Well, I've always enjoyed building things and then stepping back and taking a look at what I've accomplished. I think that's extremely gratifying. And I think particularly here in Alaska, you spend so much time indoors in the winter, it's very nice to feel comfortable with where you're living and be able to kick back in your living room and put your feet up next to the stove and have a little bit of pride in your home is much more of a home. And I think that really helps getting through the long, cold winters.
Do you have any ideas, Darwin, on why so many people decide to go the do-it-yourself route here?
Well, I think we have a pretty unique population in Fairbanks, for one thing. We're kind of on the fringe of a lot of things. We have people coming from so many different areas. We have a lot of different ideas here and a lot of independence. And I think that's, to me, the motivation for a lot of people, that they are independent. They want to create something for themselves. And a house is a real logical thing. And mm-hmm. So I see a lot of that here. I think there's a lot of people willing to try things rather than look in the yellow pages and find out somebody that's already listed.
Mm-hmm.
Not being afraid to make a mistake, mm-hmm. possibly, but just being willing to step out and do something. I think there's a lot of that in this town. I think that's a real plus.
Mm-hmm. We've had several shows that have revolved one way or another around this topic, and I think it certainly creates an atmosphere where people can come up with some very inventive, ingenious solutions when they're out there trying it themselves, and if they haven't had a formal background, they may not know that some things shouldn't work, and of course some of them don't work, but then some of them do. As someone who spent 20 years helping people build, Axel, I know that you have, how was that early extension work? You toured the state? You made reference to it?
No.
Teaching courses?
Well, yeah, I did in Alaska. I did teach, mm-hmm. Was all over the state teaching adult educational type programs. When I first started out in Alaska, I had a very difficult time getting people interested in, you know, in insulation of vapor barriers, which I think is a very important part of building Alaska, even whether you build a log house. But I just kind of, the encouragement of a friend of mine, he wanted me to start to teach log cabins because so many people were interested, but I kind of poo-pooed it for a little while. But then I began to realize if I could, you know, I could have an audience of 200 people and I would give them the vapor barriers and the insulation whether they like it or not. So it really was an opener for me. I had girls in the class, and I think the ones I enjoyed the most teaching was the girls, because they have no preconceived ideas what a house really wants. They really truly want to learn, where so many of us guys, we already have preconceptions, and once we make up our mind, we can't change it.
That's right. Spend time arguing over method.
They just want to totally ignore you sometimes. I remember one time I had a class of 200 people in the class right here on campus. A couple of carpenters sitting back in the class. They really were bugging me about the thing, because they said I misrepresented that they didn't come to hear about insulation and vapor barriers. And, it was advertised as what we were going to do. But so they kept bugging me to the point I got a little bit angry with them one day, and one of the classes, and I said, "You're excused to leave anytime you wish, but in about 5 minutes I'll be back to your subject of logs." So I guess I sprung made them a little bit angry, so they went and reported to the dean. And so he sent me back a whole pile of forms that I was supposed to have all the students fill out, about the class, because of the complaint that those two guys made. But I wasn't being paid to teach at nighttime like a lot of the... Uh-huh. Academic teacher, I had to work nighttime whether I liked not be at work, so I just threw the whole thing in the waste paper bag. But then the interesting thing was that at the end of the course, I had an examination, and it was open book examination. I told you can ask your neighbors the questions or whatever you want. I said, it's totally open book. I said, you'll learn more by asking each other questions. Of course, usually you don't have those kind of exams.
Right.
But the interesting thing about it, they were arguing with each other, saying that Carlson said that. No, he did not say that, and they flunked it. They really did, because they totally closed themselves off from what I was trying to present,
uh-huh.
And I flunked them. But they are now my friends, though.
But did they build their own log homes?
I don't know if they ever did.
Before we came on the air, you said that you think you really spent a lot of time convincing people not to build log homes more than you have in teaching them how.
Well, this is true, because I don't think people really realize how much labor goes into a house, whether it's a frame house or a log house. But, of course, a log house, the pieces are so much heavier, and they don't often understand what they're really getting in, because I try to teach the weight of the material, how much it's going to weigh, and all this kind of stuff, and they just don't always appreciate that. And even a frame house, a lot of people think put the framing up and they're about done, but gee whiz, they're not even halfway through yet.
Finish takes a long time, that interior part. Audience, our number is 474-5044. If you have any questions for my guest, but also if you'd like to just share your experiences or the reasons why all of you built your own homes, I'd be delighted to hear from some of you. 474-5044.
I'd like to make one comment that when we first start out, I think another reason why so many people build houses in Alaska, that we don't have any codes like they have in Lower 40 that says you got to have a house a certain size. Here a person can pretty well build what he wants to. Sometimes it's good and sometimes bad, but I will say that for the most part, most people end up doing a real beautiful job of building a house. So it's not in Lower 48, if you're not in the union or if you don't have a license, you don't have this, you can't even build.
Mm-hmm.
They won't allow you.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're constrained by the fact that they actually can hire a contractor and get a bank loan. So many of the people I know in Alaska wanted to build on places that the bank wouldn't finance, and so they really felt they didn't have an option but to...
Well, I think there's another thing involved, too, that, I live in a subdivision. I don't necessarily want a certain kind of a house next to my house, but yet I think there are areas where a person can... And, got a big lot and lots of trees. He can build what he wants. It don't bother me, mm-hmm. as long as he don't put that specific thing right next to my house to reduce the value. But when it sits mm-hmm. out by itself, it doesn't. It has a good value, as long as it. As an example, I think a dome house is probably the most practical house. But I certainly wouldn't want a dome house next to my house. It'd be one of our houses would be totally out of place. But out right. in the woods, it's great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were saying in terms of code, You were saying that one of the best kinds of sort of minimal standards that you know of is the FHA requirements, but that people are resistant about following those because it's a government pamphlet that or government specs, but that in fact it makes good sound financial and building sense. I mean,
well, that, those were based upon a lot of a lot of experience over the years by very, very professional architects and engineers, you know. And they tried to develop a set of codes that had excellent minimum standards. Yeah, I've always thought they were very, very good, but I know most of us, including myself, will resist anything the government wants to foist on me.
That's right. I'll do it my way.
Yeah.
Well, in some, of course, locations, you can't do standard plumbing, and even electrical access is difficult for some people here.
I think to add to what Axel is saying there, the Alaska Housing Authority has made some provisions in that regard in this non-conforming loan program, where we can build on a foundation that's not perhaps what we might think in historic terms as conventional, using a composting toilet, any number of variety of things like this, putting in a water tank instead of a well, these sorts of things. And this program has certainly generated housing for people, or made housing available that was not available before. I think that's an interesting approach. Much of Alaska, southeastern, much of the outlying areas are all built, for example, on pilings.
Mm-hmm.
Southeastern is on cedar pilings. They go out in the woods and cut them, and it's not conventional in the old terminology, so to speak. And so that has helped to that.
Could we back up just a little bit? There has to be some part of the audience that doesn't even know about what the options are with logs. I mean, we could do everything from starting with a forest and going out there and cutting down our own trees, and how else do you get logs? Can you just start on some sort of basic level of the kinds of log building, log construction that exists in Fairbanks, and some of the approaches, Darwin, to start?
Sure. I guess there are several different types of logs. First of all, any of the local sawmills will either saw or mill a uniform dimensioned log. And for someone who has not built before, this is relatively easy because if you've got a strong back, you can move the material around and you can put it into place. That would not be what we probably would refer to as a so-called natural log home, where you take a tree, peel it by hand with a draw knife, move it around, obviously with a piece of equipment, as Axel mentioned earlier, you just physically can't handle the pieces that are required. So you have to have equipment to do this, or some pretty elaborate rigging. Can do it by hand with a slow, tedious process. There's a lot of that. There has been a lot of that. A lot of beautiful places have been built that way. And those of us who have done that probably have an old military truck, and we have an A-frame rigged up on the front with a strong winch. We'll pick them up and move those around and put them in place. If you're an average do-it-yourselfer, you probably wouldn't have access to that equipment. You mentioned also, Patty, about getting the logs. All of the places that I have ever built, I've purchased the logs. I've never gotten a state permit and cut those. I don't know a great deal about that. Certain allowances are made to get a certain number of footage of logs, similar to the firewood permit. It's a house log permit. The only problem with that is that you have to have equipment to handle it. You have to hire someone, perhaps, to go out into the woods and to skid it out, load it up, and so forth. So it's not as simple as you might imagine. You get a little bit more involved very quickly than you might have thought initially. And so what I've always done is purchased the logs from a local logger. He has the equipment to handle them and so forth. If you're in the building business, it's very trying to make a living at it. You cannot be in the logging business too.
Right,
you know, very difficult, I think, to do both and do a good job at one.
Yeah, it would never occur to me that it was simple. It seems to me like really backbreaking complex. I mean, a lot of steps to the procedure to get the final materials that you need for a house. We have a listener who called in. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
Hi. Can I speak to Axel?
Yes. Go right ahead.
Hi, Axel. This is Phil Yonker.
Oh, so how are you?
Good. I wanted to share something. I'm out in my shop here hanging some, getting ready to hang some closet doors. We built this past fall, and we put a vaulted ceiling in and didn't want to go with box trusses or something that destroyed the lines of the house. So I put up the rafters and then went on the outside and just used some scrap lumber to tie them together so that they were all well aligned. Then came back on the inside and put up my visqueen and my sheetrock, and then went on the outside and sprayed 8 inches of urethane over the top of the sheetrock, and then we put the roof on. We went through this winter, and we've had, as far as we can tell, we've had real good luck with it, but I'd like to hear your comments on it.
Well, I can't exactly visualize exactly what you're doing, but you did put a vapor barrier on the warm side, so you shouldn't really have any problem with something like that.
Yeah, we did the same thing. We had one area in our house has a flat attic type, and we did the same thing there. We put up the sheetrock and visqueen, and then we went in and sprayed 1.5 inches of urethane in that attic and sealed it clear out to the wall's edges, and then came back and put 12 inches of fiberglass on top.
Mm-hmm.
So we were a little concerned that maybe we were getting so tight we wouldn't breathe at all.
Well, of course, if you've done a real good job of sealing the vapor barrier, and you don't have any things like recessed lighting fixtures and things like that, you really shouldn't have any problems. But in many houses where they get into trouble, and one reason why I always recommend ventilation on the top of the insulation is the fact that we know many people cannot get a perfect vapor barrier. So if the vapor gets up in the roof cavity, you'd like to vent it out. But I haven't seen exactly how you did the house, and I'm trying to visualize what you did do.
Well, we've got, by putting the urethane down next to the sheetrock, we put in 8 inches of it, which is an R55.
Oh, yeah, well, of course.
And then we have 1.5 inches of dead airspace, and then just the plywood sheathing, and then, a 300-pound fiberglass shingle. So the roof actually can breathe from
one end to the
other.
Where did you put your electrical wiring?
There is no wiring in our ceilings.
Well, then you've
eliminated all of that.
Then you've eliminated all the basic problems you run into when you don't put the electrical wiring in there.
In our flat ceilings, where we had flat ceilings, we do have recessed lights in all those rooms. But we went up in there, and after we put our sheetrock up, we built a sheetrock box totally around the recessed light. And then when we sprayed those ceilings, we just used 1.5 inches to seal everything, and we literally sealed it with 1.5 inches of urethane totally, and then put fiberglass on top of it. The wiring in that case is actually buried in that 1.5 inches of urethane.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it sounds like you've done a good job, and if you got some ventilation over the top of things, so something should happen to get through, you can get it vented out. But which means then that you need, in that type of construction, you still need open eaves or some air can get into the thing and vent that moisture out. But the way you've done it, it seems to me that you've got a minimum problem of getting vapor in there.
Yeah, we had some icing on our windows in the first couple of months this year, I guess about 2.5 months, only in about 1.5 to 2 inches along each one of the windows, and then by now it's completely disappeared. We don't have any icing at all around the windows at the last real cold spell. We didn't get any at all. We didn't get done painting on the inside till November, so we had a lot of melt moisture trapped in there for a while, I'm sure.
Yeah, timing is really critical. Thank you for your call. We have another caller. I hope you keep listening in. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, good evening. I had a question regarding walls and frame construction, and that was what's the cost effectiveness and ratio in the three types of wall, 2x6, 2x8, and double wall, 2x4?
I've worked that out for bid purposes, and I don't have those numbers with me right now. And of course, you have to update them with the prices in lumber.
I would say this, that when you're building a house, what I find as a builder, most people, when you begin to talk with them, the first session I have with them, they're already telling me what color they want their bathtub. I think that's the approach that you should be looking at, what the question that you're asking. That is, the framing materials are not the biggest expense of your house. You know, a couple $1,000 will go a long way versus a 2x6 wall versus a 2x10 wall, double wall with offset studs. I've worked out, you know, square footage costs for that. And so I think your money is really well spent, for example, in double wall construction. Putting in that insulation, getting that vapor barrier sealed and caulked all the seams and that sort of thing. I think you'd be surprised at the percentage difference from a 2x6 to a 2x10. I wish I could give you the actual percentages. I worked that out here. If you, it's sometime for last season. I haven't updated it. But it's not as much as you might imagine in the framing costs, where you really end up, you know, the total cost of your house, where the costs get out of hand, is when you begin to choose your lighting fixtures, your plumbing fixtures, and, well,
hardware,
what you might say,
the
accessories sort of thing. But I think you'd be really pleasantly surprised to find that the cost difference percentage-wise, maybe between in the framing materials alone, is less than 10%. I'm kind of speaking off the top of my head, but from a 2x6 to a 2x10 double wall plate stripped out with Scandinavian-style stripping, you're in that vicinity anyway. Of course, you've got the additional insulation, but that's money well spent as well.
What kind of increase in heat retention capacity are we talking about? What kind of R values? What
you from an R6 to you're probably looking at double, say 19 to upwards of above 40, depending on what you do. But you know, if you use R6, you're looking at 19 fiberglass. Is that right, Axel? Mm-hmm. I think that's right. So you'd be looking at double the R factor. And another thing I might mention too, while I'm thinking about it, is that the total cost of your payment, assuming you're borrowing money to buy a house, most people look at what their monthly payment is going to be. But you got to look at the total thing. What does it cost to live in that thing? Does it cost $500 a month to heat it, or does it cost $55? And that's another way in which to amortize that cost. I'm not sure I've answered your question.
I've looked at it in the same light now. I begin to understand what the question was, but I've done some very careful cost analysis of house construction, and I found that the savings in energy between a super insulated house and, say, a 2x4 or 2x6 stud wall, the savings is enough to pay for the extra mortgage payments for that extra insulation. And I've even done this in Pennsylvania for my daughter. I've discovered that at my daughter's in Pennsylvania, you can afford to have more insulation in the walls down there than we can in Alaska, because there's lumber is probably, well, is a lot less cost. The labor is a lot less cost, but they're paying the same cost for fuel oil as I'm paying. In fact, they spend more, both of my daughters spend more for fuel oil in their house than I pay in my house in Alaska. And I don't have nothing fancy, but I'm just saying it. Mm-hmm. I like to look at the savings that you have in mortgage payments, and it mm-hmm. turns out that you can actually, it'll actually pay for itself to put the extra mm-hmm. insulation.
I don't did I hear Phil right? Did he say his R value in his ceiling was 54?
55, I think.
55. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is the recommended R value for walls and ceilings in Alaska? What would both of you recommend
this
time?
I can't speak for your thing, but I can speak by using fiberglass. I would say probably, 18 in the ceiling and 18, 16 inches in the wall, with, you know, wall with double frame, mm-hmm. double framing in it.
Excuse me. When you're talking about this 10%, are you including, is that including labor? What is that including?
Yeah, I was thinking in terms of material, but now just speaking, everybody has their own method of doing things. And I build double wall exclusively now, as many other builders are doing. And once you get your system set up, your labor difference is not, it's really minimal in a double wall versus a single wall. I find from the way I do it. Now, I've heard some people will attack and, you know, will say that that's not true, but I honestly think if you're set up and you have your method down and something that you feel comfortable with, and each builder, I suppose, has a particular method he works with, that the differential in labor is very minimal. I'm sure there's people who would disagree with me on that, but from my point of view and the way in which we do it, I really think that most of your costs would be in the added insulation and the added framing kind of material.
Okay, well, thank you for your answer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your question. Our number is 474-5044 for anyone else in the audience who has a question or a suggestion. So you're saying that's a question of technique once you get your techniques worked out and your methods.
I really think from at least from my point of view, I think it is. It's an interesting question that the lady had, and I suspect that the question as to what she was directing toward Axel, what's minimal for our climate, is a good question. And I think that maybe the high R values that we're talking about, double wall, 10 and 12 inch walls, and whatever we're just talking about, is minimal. There is one other problem, and I'll say this with a possibility of some disagreement too, and maybe we'll get a call on it. The reason I think that, you know, this is probably minimal construction for our climate, but it's maximum what you can do as a builder and make a living doing it. The reason for that is that an appraisal will reflect a square footage value. A guy will come out and measure the outside of your building, not asking really specific questions about the thickness of your wall, what it's going to cost somebody to live in there, like Axel alluded to just a minute ago, your mortgage payment, but you also have to heat it, you have to do all of this. So until we have a different approach on the appraisal system, not based on a market value, but based on a performance situation, mm-hmm. we're not going to see a lot of different housing or better housing. It's only going to be people who demand that and a few conscientious people who are doing that on their own. Mm-hmm. You mentioned self-builders, and a lot of those people are doing that.
Well, I have found that the Alaska peaks, you know, savings and loan banks are more receptive to the superinsulated house and are willing to loan the money for mm-hmm. that. But quite often, a lot of money comes from the lower 40, Fannie Mae and lower 48. They want to build the maximum number of houses, you know, for the least amount of money. And you know, yeah. if you're in that business.
And square footage is a real important part of that criteria.
People look at square footage too much. And that's why I say the market approach is wrong, and the performance approach, or whatever you want to call it, should be the way we go about things. I think that, you know, the Alaska banks are definitely receptive, but if you're buying a house, you can borrow 90% of the money to buy that house. You can be financed for 90%. If you're building it, you can be financed for 80%. 80% of what? 80% of appraised value. Uh-huh. And there's incredible discrepancies in that appraised value. 2x6 wall, why should that appraise the same as a 2x12 wall? Uh-huh. That's my question, and I think it's a viable one. Uh-huh. The Alternative Energy Conference brought out some of this. We had some interesting discussions on that at that time from some of the Canadians and a fellow that was here from Seattle. But I feel pretty strongly about that.
Yes, and I think we need to start, well, before the show we were talking about Scandinavia and some of the building practices there, and that they have much smaller houses or attached houses or apartments. Much of the population lives in apartments, but they've gone for very elegant interior finishes. The kind of craftsmanship and the kind of use of space is very fine, and so may not be so large a structure, which makes it efficient to heat, but may have a real elegance and a real... good finish, but on the square footage, if square footage is the criteria, then that's not going to value out or appraise out as high. We have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I was with all the talk of super insulated houses and vapor barriers. I was wondering if maybe we could hear comments on indoor air quality, and some of the questions have come up about that.
Uh-huh. Well, the indoor quality has become a problem because the more insulation we put on the houses, and we're making them tighter because we're trying to get rid of the infiltration heat losses. So, and also to avoid getting moisture in the insulation, we're particularly in the super insulated houses, we're getting very, very careful now, particularly in Canada, as to how the vapor barrier is put in, to the point where the houses are getting so tight. I've had several calls in the last few years by people who built a super insulated house, and they were absolutely couldn't believe that they should have condensation problems on a super insulated house. And this is houses with three panes of glass in, but they somehow or other, I guess we fail to realize sometimes the tighter we get the house, the tighter the relative humidity becomes, the more condensation problems they have. And of course, also at the same time, many of us have been brainwashed over the years, I guess you use that word, that we think we have to have a certain minimum relative humidity. Exactly what that is, but it varies from people to people, from doctors to... some doctors like to have it as high as they can, up around 40-50%, but you just can't tolerate this. And even in spite of the... Well, I've been in some houses where they have triple pane glass, no problem with condensation in the center of the glass. It's always around the rim because of that lumen channel. So windows still have a... In kind of way are controlling what kind of relative humidity that you want in the house. If you got a beautiful view like I have, well, I don't want any frost on my windows.
Uh-huh.
So I have a real problem. And this last couple of years, my daughter and son-in-law moved into my house. They brought their dog and their cat, and then my son who helped move them up, he brought a dog. And of course, my dog is outside, but their dogs have to be in the house. And our humidity in the last 2 years has gone from 25% to 55%, and I have nothing but condensation troubles on my old-fashioned storm windows.
Animals breathing?
You know, the only way an animal cools off is by panting, and that panting is moisture.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way they lose their moisture.
That never occurred to me, but of course, that's right. So dogs in cars, they get the whole car steamed up and iced up. Your dogs, Carl, I know Carl has dogs. You keep yours outside or inside causing humidity problems?
Mine generally stay outside.
We got sort of far afield from air quality. We started talking about humidity. Do you have another part of that question, listener?
Well, I was just wondering if there's any way of coping with indoor air quality, especially if you, well, when I'm going to be building, I probably won't have electricity for a while, but I'm planning to go with a super insulated house. So I was wondering how it could be dealt with, or if I should really have to worry about it.
Well, I don't want to take the ball from somebody else, but I will. One way, if you have no electricity, a way of releasing the vapor pressure or relieving the vapor pressure is do like the native Eskimo used to do. You build a vent tube. Well, in fact, I saw this up in the village Inuvik several years ago. They had a new native housing program there. Beautiful houses, but they're small. And every one of the houses that we went through, they all had a real bad condensation trouble on the windows and also on the plate at the top of one at the bottom. Except one, and this one couple was an old Eskimo couple, and I asked them, how come you don't have condensation troubles in your house like everybody else did? Well, they showed me what they had. They had a wooden tube right above the kitchen sink, not the kitchen sink, but the kitchen stove that went right straight through the ceiling and right straight through the attic and was vented outdoors. And of course, the way they control the ventilation on that thing is whenever they're butchering a lot of meat, or when they're doing laundry, hanging laundry inside the house, all they did is pull the tufted glass cloth out of this tube and just let the vapor relief, which it will do. You know, you can get a vapor pressure in a house, say at 30% relative humidity, of around 16 pounds per square foot, which people don't really realize.
I saw a similar thing in Norway a year ago, which I was really impressed with. I'm not sure that it would work in our climate, but what you said, not possibly having electricity, and that's obviously a problem in running a air-to-air heat exchanger, which of course is going to cost you $1,000 on up to run that, and there's various different models. But what we saw over there, it was on a latitude similar to Anchorage, and so we're just a little bit, have more extreme temperatures and so forth, but in most of the rooms they had something similar to what Axel was talking about. At the top, it was at the top of the wall, had a little square deal. It looked like 4 or 5 inches square, and I'd looking at it, I would have guessed it probably cost about $7 or something like that. And it had a series of notches on it. It was strictly manually operated. And the room that we were sleeping in with these friends over there that we were staying with had one of these, and I went up, when it was blowing out, I went up, crawled up to that thing, I felt it, I tried to do everything just to see what if there was draft coming into the room and so forth. It was, I think the Scandinavians have really good housing for European countries, and I think healthy housing, and maybe perhaps because they get proper ventilation, I think that is a problem. We got so many products now. They use a lot more wood than we do. Carpets and glues and all of the things that we put together or manufacture, formaldehydes and all the things that I'm sure that most people are aware of, are contributing to this. We need to get rid of or have some proper ventilation. And they also still put cranks on windows, you know, so you can crank open a window fairly inexpensively, which may not be the best solution, but might be healthy.
Another thing, talking about Scandinavia, another thing I noticed that they do there, and my mother used to do, but of course in the old days in Scandinavia, they had a lot of trouble with tuberculosis. And part of this came about because they had small houses, tight houses, and with high humidity. And with high humidity, you get lots more respiratory disease.
Mm-hmm.
But what they used to do, they'd take all the bed clothing and hang it out in the porch. And you still see this going on, some of the old timers in Scandinavia, they hang all the bedding outdoors to ventilate. They open up the bedroom windows for maybe an hour or so, and just, you know, they shut the other door so you don't lose a lot of heat, but just to relieve the pollution in the air.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very interesting call and something that clearly needs to be considered. I have another caller, so did you have another?
No, that's it. That? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was planning on building this summer, and one of the things that we were thinking about incorporating into the design of the house was indoor garden sun space and heat collection system. Now, some of the folks that I talked to said that there's too much moisture generated by the plants. And I guess you were talking about that earlier with the vapor.
Well, this would be a problem, I would say definitely, because anytime you put water in plants, it's going to find itself back out through the leaves. So you need to provide some ventilation to relieve that. And, of course, the colder the weather is, the more trouble you're going to have with condensation on windows and things like that. So you have to use a little bit of judgment when you have your own plants. But this time of the year, you could use an attached greenhouse, if you want to call it, to your house. And it's a great time now for propagating plants, but I don't think you'd want to do that all year round unless you really design the house for that purpose, which means a super job of sealing the vapor barrier. So you got no electrical wiring, no kind of openings in your vapor barrier. So if you're going to do that, you got to plan it now. Don't wait until you got a carpenter up and tell him what you want done. You better know what you want and have it on the plan so he knows.
Has there been any designs like that in Fairbanks that have been successful?
Well, I would say they're successful if you watch, you know, the humidity in the house, you know, during extremely cold weather, you know, when it's minus 40, 50 below zero, you're going to have some troubles, and you're probably going to have some, what you want to do then is maybe put some kind of insulation on the outside of your glass. Another thing you might do, and my son tried it in his own house, he took some styrofoam, and I tried it in the basement myself, but he put the styrofoam right tight to the glass for insulation. Of course, you'll get some accumulation of moisture between the glass and the styrofoam, but then eventually it freezes and seals itself, so you can't get it off until the sun comes back on again. But in the depth of winter, there really isn't enough sunshine to really, for plant growth, so you have to have some supplemental lighting for plant growth. So maybe what you want to do is close up some of those windows where you're going to have a real big problem.
And also the type of heating system that you have would be really important, I think, whether you're heating your air or heating hot water, whether you have a wood stove in your house. All of these things would be a factor in your humidity and your air temperature.
But all I would say, just take extra special care on the vapor barrier everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Caulk it.
That means that at the, well, at rim joists, about any place you can think of, you want to do a lot of planning on it.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you for your question. Yes, some of the reading I've done just recommends extended greenhouses, which extend your season by starting opening them up at this time of year, and then you get some extra time at the other, at the end of the summer, but not that it's really a difficult task through the darkest and coldest part of the winter.
Well, I don't think it's so difficult if you really understand and appreciate the importance of vapor control. And when you get into a problem, then have some way that you can cover up that glass.
Mm-hmm.
Provides, because you're not going to get much sunshine, say, in, well, December, January, February, you might as well give up then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's the key, being able to cut that. Carl, did you make any mistakes as you started that you'd like to share with us? The phones have not been ringing with people who are telling me about their mistakes tonight. Did you do it right from the beginning, or did you run into any things that some of these people who are about to build might?
Well, I'm sure that it's not perfect. There was, I think, a lot of small errors. I don't think I made any gross or major errors. I definitely under-insulated my first cabin that I built. It's 6-inch three-sided logs in the first place, with only 6 inches of fiberglass in the ceiling. And it's a very tight cabin, and it's easy to heat because it's small, but I definitely need to keep a fire going in the cabin to keep it warm. It doesn't hold heat as long. And my new house is a little over 4 times the square footage, and it cost me a little bit less to heat my new house than the old house, because I have 12-inch logs instead of 6, and 18 inches of fiberglass instead of 6 for ceiling and floor, or roof and floor. So it's quite a bit of difference, and like Darwin was saying earlier, you certainly can recoup the small cost, or increased cost, of the extra insulation. I think that was really the major mistake that I made, or the corner that I cut that I shouldn't have.
I'd like to ask you a question as to how did you get that amount of insulation in your floor? You said 16, did I understand?
Well, the floor actually is 12 on 2x12s. That's a little overstuffed with fiberglass.
Okay.
And sealed on the outside with plywood also underneath to keep the critters out of the fiberglass.
I think in talking about insulation of floor, I think is a way that you can quite economically, at least in my opinion, of getting more insulation to floors, is to use what I call a lumber plywood beam, using 2x4 top and bottom cords and say half inch plywood as the flanges, so you can build the floor up any depth that you want. Of course, it does cause some problem in the height of the building, but I think, in my opinion, I think the most important place to insulate a house is the floor, because that's where you live, that's where you play during the waking hours. If you got a cold floor, you got a cold house, no matter what happens to the ceiling.
That's true.
That's where you're going to live. Another interesting thing I've discovered about super insulated houses is I've measured, well, there's a super insulated house that has a wall height of, what is it, 16 foot high from floor to the cathedral type ceiling. And with that house, I've only been able to measure a temperature differential of around 2 degrees between the floor and ceiling. But if you take a conventional house, say with 6 inches of fiberglass, I've measured as much as 20 degrees difference between the floor and the ceiling.
Your head is a lot hotter than your feet.
What type of heat did that particular house have?
Just an old-fashioned wood stove. That's all they had in the thing.
So nothing was moving in terms of forced air moving or fans or anything like that?
But there was enough mass in that insulation. If you get enough of it in there, it also acts as a heat sink.
Then you equilibrate, you reach an equilibrium.
And then the other thing that happens, the more insulation that you have, the closer the floor temperature becomes to the air temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But in a 2x6 wall, 2x6 wall with 6-inch fiber, you could have as much as 7 degrees temperature difference between the surface and the floor and the air immediately above it. So that what that does is start generating stratification. Then you have 20 degrees, and that gets kind of rough.
which is really important for our climate because the number, large number of buildings are up off the ground because of ground conditions on piling on a pad that has air circulation underneath. So that's really important, I think. I've been trying to say,
if you can't afford to put, you know, a lot of insulation out, put it all on the floor, and then later on put it in the ceiling. But the floor, to me, is the most important place.
But that's exactly the opposite of what the general thinking was for years and years and years. It was to put it up.
I think part of that came about because all the older houses in the lower 48 always had a furnace in the basement, so your basement was always warm. So as a result, you always had warm floors. You know, but that same principle does. We never thought about it as far as open posts and piers.
Didn't examine the assumption under which the construction was going. And so, well, there have been tremendous changes, whether by professional builders or do-it-yourselfers in Fairbanks in just, I'm sure, the last 10 years. Those cabins that are sort of sinking into the ground are that I don't think happens very often anymore, or does it?
Well, I don't think so much. We've seemed to have learned from all of that, and have seen enough examples around. And plus, too, there are more requirements. We still don't have the codes that Axel was talking about earlier, but there are more requirements in terms of the kinds of ground and soil testing and so forth that goes along with what most people do, get a mortgage. If you build on the board a month plan, maybe you're not involved with all of this, but we are exposed to, have more requirements of us now in terms of our building.
We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wasn't listening real closely, but I thought I heard some mention about overstuffing with insulation to increase the R value. And I know I've heard of it from various builders in town before, but it's my general impression that actually, that might be reducing the R value, although I've never heard that mentioned. I'm wondering if anyone knows anything about that.
Well, yeah, there are tables on it. You can. I can't give you any specific figures. If you wanted to call me sometime at home, I could give you. I'll show you a table. But you can stuff an extra amount of insulation. It does reduce the insulation somewhat, but it's really not as bad. You got a point where you got to stop. Otherwise, you pack it up until you got just a block of glass, but There is a table that was developed by Owens Corning Glass many years ago, but you have to be kind of careful of the ratio that you put in there. So it can be done.
So overstuffing a little bit does
help
increase things.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
I think you're more likely to get a good solid fit too in the corners if you're overstuffing by a small amount, instead of getting a loose fit around the edges where you're going to get a lot of air movement.
Well, we're getting a little bit short on time. I wanted to ask you a few questions because I saved this for the show. I talked to Axel last fall, and he was about to leave on a trip to Pennsylvania, and he was going to look at some log structures there. And you said before we came on the air that there was a large number of log buildings there, but we don't realize how many there were because they covered them with clapboard.
Yeah. Well, the same thing was true. I didn't learn until say 1968 when I went on sabbatic leave. As well, that's when I discovered how many log houses there are in Scandinavia. That's Norway, Sweden, and Finland. From the outside they look like a frame house, but they really are log walls. They're 6-inch logs that are slapped off on each side, so the wall is more or less perfectly flat. And then of course in those days, they didn't have good chinking like we have now, so the chinking would fall out. So they finally would stucco the inside with plaster, and then they plaster the outside with plaster. Their terminology is reverse, but anyway, to stop the air leakage. But I really was amazed. And the same thing in Pennsylvania. A large number of the old homes are log construction, but they're heavy oak logs, 6 inches thick. And of course, the timber they have is very irregular surface. So you usually end up with about a 2-inch crack in between the logs, and they stuff it full in those days it used to be a hair plaster. But then they, I was amazed. I didn't really realize that, that there
was. And
then
they covered it with clapboard on the outside,
and so then they
didn't need such uniform fits with the logs.
Yeah.
That sort of compensated for that as well. And here, Of course, I don't know whether it's, I think partly it's the aesthetic. People go to great pains to really make the natural look of the inside, yeah, and the
incidentally,
outside.
Incidentally, I've noted now that a lot of people are taking the clapboard off the outside, and then the white plaster shows, and really, they're the most attractive houses I've ever seen, but then they're insulating the inside. Maybe they put 2x4 studs or something like that to insulate from it, mm-hmm. but I think, in a way, it's backward, but but they like the looks of those, and it's very attractive. It really is,
mm-hmm.
with the white horizontal strips of white plaster and then the oak log.
And those logs have aged under special conditions because they've been protected really from the weather all these years. Well, log construction seems to last quite well. Is it?
Yeah. Well, I think our climate here, anything lasts if it's done reasonably well. We have very little wind. We have no driving rain like so many areas. We have cold weather, which I guess is pretty good preservative. We just don't have a lot of the similar problems, hot, humid kinds of things to cause rot and decay. So if you have a good foundation and take care of the moisture problems that we've talked about off and on this evening, there's no question about whether it'll last a long time.
I like to see overhangs on log houses. To me, it makes it look a lot more attractive. Not only that, it protects the wall from the rain.
Yeah, I think it balances the large lines. It just helps the looks of the building as well as, like you say, protect it.
Any comments on roof pitch for Fairbanks?
Well, about the only thing I could say on it, I guess the steeper the roof, I guess the easier the snow slides off. So, and probably if you're going to build a cathedral ceiling, the steeper the roof, the smaller the timbers have to be to support the roof. But I don't think that's really a great problem.
If you got a little snow up here, you got a little added insulation, and it really depends on the structural members of the roof itself. And it also depends on the labor involved. I think as a builder, you have a responsibility not only to build a good product, but you also have a responsibility to build one within a price range that people can afford. Mm-hmm. And if you get really steep and lots of angles and dormers and all the things that might look nice, then we're adding to the cost of it. So we have to look at that aspect too. Mm-hmm. Structurally, I don't think there's any difference as long as it's done right.
But you don't recommend flat roofs for Fairbanks, or it doesn't matter?
Well, I guess even that is most of the commercial buildings are flat roof, but they go in different applications and something that a homeowner might not do. Hot mopping tarry doesn't have the equipment, for example. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at something completely different, and having a drainage system on your roof, we take care of it simply by putting a pitch to it and letting the water run off on its own.
Mm-hmm.
A flat roof would work, I think, but it's just not something that most people would really, I wouldn't like it myself. I wouldn't advocate it for sure.
Well, we were talking earlier that, in fact, some people do have some considerable problems with glaciation here if we get the right kind of breakup and...
Well, of course, part of the problem of glaciation, one of the things is not enough insulation, and the other thing that we in Alaska like to build what I would call a cold roof. You know, we like to put insulation with an airspace above it so that you don't get any, you get a certain amount of leakage of heat through insulation, and if you've sealed the eaves tight and that heat gets up there, you can still have glaciation at the eaves. So unless you get into a real super... Well, I've even seen glaciation on super insulated roof if the roof cavity got too tight, partly because they allowed some air leaks. Mm-hmm. Electrical wiring or something happened. The vapor barrier was not properly sealed.
I think it boils down to that. You can put all the insulation in the world in there, but unless it's done properly, you're going to... could still see, like you say, glaciation. Could still have a problem. And it really does boil down to that, just not only proper materials, but proper installation.
Mm-hmm. The Cooperative Extension Office still carries many of your pamphlets, Axel, on all different aspects of building, everything from insulation. Do you update these, or...?
Well, I tried it, and of course, they do have a Rich Seifert that's replaced me, and he's working to try to update things, too. So.
We've had Rich on the program and so on. So anyone who is planning on undertaking a building project, I recommend that. There's a new book out on log building that's been fairly well reviewed. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Tom Walker's book. I don't know if any of you have looked at it. What do you think?
Well, I haven't really looked at it close enough to argue one way or the other.
The only thing I look for
is to see if, I tried to see if it called for a vapor bear, and I didn't get a chance to really see if it did. That would be the only thing where I might quibble. And whether it has or not, I don't know, but I'm going to look into it.
Okay, we'll get back to that later. I wish all of you very good luck on your building projects this summer. I'd like to thank Axel Carlson, Darwin Syme, and Carl Castle for being with me this evening. And I hope to talk to you next week at this time. Good night.
And you're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's 8 o'clock in the evening, and we will be joining a Prairie Home Companion.